is now in its 14th year, with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Christina Ferrazzuti, who is doing a Master of Science in Biomedical and Molecular Sciences under the supervision of Dr. Charles Gray and Dr. Tiziana Codacchini. Welcome to Grad Chat, Christina.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, okay, give me a bit of background. So you're doing your master's, but what did you do before doing your master's?
Yeah, so I did my master's at Queen's as well, homegrown. I did a bachelor's of science in life sciences, where I specialized in biomedical discovery. Through that opportunity, I had a chance to dip my toes into research through an undergraduate thesis project, looking at basically cross-generational outcomes of inflammatory pregnancies, which I'll get a bit more into later, but basically how those pregnancies have long-lasting effects on the kidney health of both the mothers and offspring.
So, and that was all from a bachelor's?
Yes, that was all from my undergraduate work. And I really fell in love with research, so then my supervisor snapped me up and we decided to embark on a master's together. And yeah, that's where I'm at now.
That's brilliant. So Christina's research topic is the, and of course in biomedical and molecular sciences, they are pretty long titles. It's called The Innate Immune Reprogramming and Risk of Pregnancy Complications, i.e. why one complicated pregnancy can lead to another, the role of the immune memory. Which I kind of liked that thing in brackets. That was really good.
Yeah, I thought I'd slide it in there just given the general format of this.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this particular project. What are you trying to accomplish here? What is it that you're talking about? You know, innate immune reprogramming and risk of pregnancy complications. So explain that a little bit more and then how you're going about doing that.
Yeah, so basically, in epidemiological literature, it's been really shown that individuals who have inflammatory pregnancy complications are at an oftentimes greater risk of experiencing those complications in future pregnancies.
Okay.
So basically, what we're doing in the lab is finding a way and explaining, okay, how does this happen at the cellular level? What dynamic changes are happening within the maternal physiological systems, like the systems within the body, to mediate these pregnancy complications and how that translates into later life health outcomes. So specifically to what I'm modeling is recurrent pregnancy loss, which affects like
a lot of people, I've
1-2% of all individuals who are trying to get pregnant.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a lot. Is that a Canadian stat or?
Globally.
Globally.
Yeah. So recurrent pregnancy loss is defined as having two or more miscarriages. So basically pregnancy loss before 24 weeks of pregnancy.
Okay.
So basically two of those. But if we look into the statistics of recurrent pregnancy loss, if you have one pregnancy loss, the next pregnancy being lost is you have a 12 to 20% risk of that pregnancy being lost. And then it's 29% in a second pregnancy after that loss.
So it continues to rise.
Correct. And by a third pregnancy, the risk of it resulting in pregnancy loss is 36%.
Ooh.
So it's not even just a persistent increased risk. It's a compounded risk between pregnancies. So basically what we're trying to do is answer, why does this happen? What is being changed to make this happen?
Right. So you're not really looking, well, I guess maybe you are, at the first loss.
So within our model, we're looking at an inflammatory pregnancy. So using an animal model of inflammation-induced pregnancy loss.
So when you say inflammation, though,
yes.
What do you mean by that? I mean, I know what inflammation is in general, but how does that relate in a pregnancy?
Yeah. So if we think of inflammation just being as heightened immune activation, so okay. Your immune system is working extra hard mm-hmm. and think of it as like a hot environment. There's a lot of activity that could result in bad outcomes.
Right.
So within a normal pregnancy of itself, like there's inflammation, that's good. We want that process to happen at the beginning of pregnancy to allow for the placenta to develop, for there right. to be like vascular remodeling. So changes in blood vessels that allows for the placenta to have access to maternal circulation.
Right. So there's good parts to it, but then it goes a bit crazy.
Yes,
for some
exactly.
reason. That's the bit you're looking at. Why is it going crazy?
Exactly. So if we look into the like typical shifts in the immune system throughout a pregnancy, after you have that pro-inflammatory state, so where you want all that inflammation, it usually shifts to a tolerogenic state or anti-inflammatory state to support the fetus.
Right.
So I guess in like medical jargon, it's semi-allogeneic, but basically what that means is it shares half of the DNA from the mother and then half the DNA from the father.
Right.
So being semi-allogeneic, allogeneic being just like not of the same. So it's recognized almost as like a foreign body. So how do right. we protect that from the maternal immune system? So then that's when we have the tolerogenic phase, and then pregnancy, like the act of delivery, is a pro-inflammatory phase.
Okay.
But basically in pregnancy complications such as recurrent pregnancy loss, spontaneous pregnancy loss, fetal growth restriction, preeclampsia is a big one in the clinic that's right. being looked at. All of these pregnancy complications are marked by having inflammation during those tolerogenic phases, during phases where there's not supposed to be inflammation.
Right.
So that's what we're seeing in the first pregnancies there. And then in the model that I'm looking at to answer these questions, we're not giving them any sort of exogenous stimuli. We're not injecting them with anything again. We're just letting them have a second pregnancy.
Right, and see what happens.
And seeing what happens. And we do see differences. So there is some like functional differences happening within the immune cells, both in the uterus and like in circulation. For my project specifically, I look at the maternal fetal interface. So I just look at the uterine microenvironment. So the cells in the uterus.
Right.
And how they're changed and how they're reprogrammed, as the title of my project suggests. I look at innate immune reprogramming. So just as a general, super general overview of right. the immune system, you have two branches.
So I take it you must have something to compare against.
Yes.
Because otherwise, how do you know it's that part that's causing the issues?
The best part of experimental design, the best thing you could learn when you're starting out in research is understanding proper controls.
Yes.
So in my case, we have controls that are not pregnant that get the treatment that induces inflammation. We also have controls that are pregnant and then don't have any sort of stimulus on them.
Right.
Just to see like the different groups. So yeah, the best part of experimental design and like probably the most integral part to validate what you're finding in your experiment is having the proper controls.
Now, with that, though, you were saying you're looking at what's going on in the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
How are you seeing those differences? Is it a chemical difference? Is the cell looking different? What differences are you seeing? And at this point, if you can even say it, is there a very specific time, other than in that period that you were talking about, but is there a specific time when you start to see these yeah. changes happening?
So that's a great question. So in terms of what we're looking at the uterine cells, so my specific interest is in a cell type called a macrophage.
Okay.
So a macrophage is an innate immune cell that is known to basically eat up debris. Yeah, perfect.
Like Pac-Man.
Yeah, exactly. I hope people on the podcast could imagine us making the Pac-Man hands as we say this. But basically, beyond that, macrophages have a very important role in kind of, I like to think of them as like orchestrating other cells. A lot of innate immune cells do that as well, but macrophages exhibit a very high degree of plasticity. So they're able to change and modulate their behaviors.
Okay.
But also within that cell, like within that cell category, there's a lot of heterogeneity. So there's a lot of different polarizations of macrophages. There's a lot of like different populations that do different things.
Okay. Yep.
So my interest in macrophages came from previous work done in my lab by actually one of my supervisors, Dr. Kodakini. Back in 2014, when she was doing her PhD, she found that there was an increased presence of macrophages at the maternal fetal interface in a similar model of fetal growth restriction mediated right. by inflammation. So using that as a jumping off point, I was then interested in looking at macrophages in the uterus, because from her work, we saw that there was macrophages coming in, there was an increase in infiltration, and then that the pregnancies resulted in fetal growth restriction, but there wasn't a functional explanation of why that happens.
Right, right.
So what then my role became was to look at these cells and understand how their function changes and how this could then result in later life outcomes, being in my case a recurrent pregnancy complication. So basically how I see these cells being different, I use like two main techniques. So one of the ways that we characterize our cells is through flow cytometry. So on cells, they express different markers on the surface. Yeah. And those markers oftentimes give us intel on their function and what they may be doing in that environment. So flow cytometry, the main thing that you do with it is that you stain the cells with antibodies that are attached to little tags called fluorophores.
Okay.
So the antibodies are specific for that cell marker. And then when it's attached, it's also attached to a little tag.
Okay.
So then after I stain all my cells, I bring it over to a cytometer, which is a big, scary, expensive machine that I have grown to love to a tremendous extent. But basically what the cytometer does, it has different lasers set at different wavelengths that emit light onto the tag that's on that antibody.
Right.
To then excite that to emit light at another thing. So basically the detectors and a bunch of computer programming tells us then, what do these cells express?
Okay, so that emitting light is, and whatever bounces off is telling you what it's
correct
emitting.
Yes, because okay. I tell the computer, okay, I have this antibody that's looking for this specific marker. I'm expecting it to emit light here.
Right.
And if we see that light is emitted there,
in a different direction, whatever, then there's a problem.
Correct.
Potential problem.
Potential problem. I mean, if it's,
or it's not,
not
behaving the way you expected it to.
Correct. Like if I have a sample and I don't see any detection in that one area, I just know, okay, maybe this marker isn't expressed in this population.
Right.
I have a panel of like 13 different markers. So
oh,
I'm
only
not...
13. I thought it'd be a lot more, to be honest.
Typically for flow cytometry panels, it really depends on what you're looking to characterize. But since I'm looking at macrophages specifically, 13 is a pretty decent panel for characterizing those populations.
Right.
You could have like upwards of 20. However, when you go beyond that, it gets difficult, because imagine you're telling a detector system, I'm shooting lasers and emitting light at a certain range here. There's going to be overlap.
Yeah.
So we can't have overlap. So it's usually capped around 20.
Right.
There's a few other like techniques if you're looking for like more just like, if you have a less targeted approach. But in my case specifically, anyways, I digress. We use flow cytometry. And then another way that I look at how these cells are different, basically I isolate macrophages in culture. So I have uterine tissue that I then create a single cell suspension out of.
Okay.
And then I isolate macrophages. It's actually a really cool process.
That must be difficult.
It's a lot of technical work, but once you get it down, you have a really strong appreciation for it.
Oh, okay.
basically, like in the protocol that we use, it's an antibody that's specific for just like a pan macrophage marker. So like a marker that we express all macrophages to express.
Okay.
And then it's connected to a little like magnetic bead. And so when we put the sample against a magnet, the bead then pulls like the macrophages to stick, and then we just collect whatever liquid's left, and those are our cells then.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really cool, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to imagine all this right now.
You're welcome to join me in the lab anytime.
I'm going to have to, I think, and yeah. I have to see this in action.
Open invitation. So when we isolate these cells, we expect them to have a different behavior, given that we expect them to be reprogrammed from that pregnancy complication.
Right.
So then I isolate those cells and then treat them with something new to see how they would react. So
when you say how they react, either go back to doing what they should be doing as opposed to...
So in terms of how they react, I look at altered cytokine responsiveness. So cytokines are proteins.
Yes, I should know that.
Yes.
I've had enough of these conversations.
And basically, they're just mediators of the immune system. They interact with other physiological systems in the body, but just for my context specifically, they're basically like little messengers, and they kind of could call cells over to a tissue being like,
right,
hey, we need your help over here, or give signals to other cells.
Can they say, stay away, please?
Yeah.
So they can block or attract.
Exactly. They are released by cells. And so cytokines are released by cells to give us an intel on like how that cell may be behaving. So when then I isolate the macrophages and have them in tissue culture, when I look at how they're behaving, that could give me an idea. Okay, they were reprogrammed from something else. If I look at how the ones that were in that pregnancy complication versus a pregnancy that wasn't complicated, how are these two different in how they behave?
Right.
And it's really interesting. And I have a few different cohorts set up. And at this point, specifically right now, I can't really comment on how, like a general, how they behave afterwards. But we are seeing altered differences from that pregnancy complication to a non-complicated state.
Well, that's good that you're seeing something, because you could be going through all this and you go, okay, I've still got nothing. Which is all the part of experiments, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like innate immune reprogramming is very broad. There's different phenotypes that we could look at within that umbrella term. So we could look at, okay, these cells that are reprogrammed, they have a more like pro-inflammatory, or like, I don't want to say angry, but like, I think angry is an apt term for right now. More of an angry response upon secondary stimulus. Or maybe they were reprogrammed to be more tolerogenic, so they have a dampened response. Maybe the cells are not reprogrammed at all and they have a different response, but it's not because of that. And that's where it comes in, that we have the appropriate controls to tease out those differences.
So can I ask you then, because this is really tricky, right? Because you can, in these experiments, find differences between your control and what's happening, and then depending on what other things you put into the that particular environment. So you can find out all of this. But once you have done that, once you say, okay, this is the issue, is it the hope then that you go, this is how this is happening? So how do we stop it from happening in the first place? Is that your ultimate hope? So first of all, your part to play is we've got to figure out why it's happening first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of it is, okay, next part is, well, how do we stop that happening in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's the dream with any research in like biomedical sciences. It's how do we understand the problem? How do we understand the mechanism in which the problem is happening? And then how do we use what we know to treat that, or have preventative measures in place? So right now, like all of my research is in an animal model or using cell culture. So basically the mechanism that we look at innate immune reprogramming is through epigenetic alterations. So epigenetics being above genetics, that's I think the proper translation of it. And it is how our DNA is regulated to turn on and off genes, right?
Okay, yep.
So when we look at these reprogrammed cells, we think differences were made at the epigenetic level to allow them to behave differently.
Right.
And so this was seen in a publication that we recently had by one of the PhD candidates in our lab, Nikisha, where she looked at blood cells that were collected from individuals who experienced preeclampsia or fetal growth restriction. And basically she found epigenetic changes within those cells.
Okay.
That would infer that there was some sort of anti-inflammatory change that happened.
Right.
So this was really cool.
So it really is the looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack, isn't it, when you're doing this? Because there is so much trial and error, and even thinking about, well, which part can we look at now? Because it's a long process.
Exactly. I think right now, one of my experiments I'm really excited for actually is looking at cells that I isolate. So the macrophages again, and then doing bulk RNA sequencing. So basically what I'm going to be doing is I'm taking the macrophages that I isolated and looking at the RNA that they recently transcribed.
Right, right, right.
So basically their last dying wish, if you will.
That's a good way of putting it. I like that. I think it's, you know, all this is fascinating because, I mean, it is down at the micro level, which, of course, it's very hard for us to understand. But I, going back to your, you know, your title, looking at reprogramming and risk of further complications. Mm-hmm. So I guess once you've figured out what's happening in your macrophage level, are you looking to for when it's gone second and third pregnancy? Are you looking also what you did in the after the first one? Are you looking at the differences after the second and third from the same?
So,
or is that too hard to do?
All of my research is in an animal model.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
As of right now, we don't have human correlates, but as we expand the project, we would be looking to do that.
Like, for instance, if for human, and I know there's a lot of protocols to go through for that, but if there was a database of certain cells that have been collected from people who have had difficulty, and then you have access to that. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's in the works right now, and that's what we're talking about, and including potentially in a project that transpired from my work.
Right. Brilliant, because I'm, you know, there's a lot of women out there who would love to have a family, from themselves,
For sure.
So that would be good. So the other question I was wondering, because you talk about this, how, you know, either have to reprogram because it's inflammation, it's a memory thing, mm-hmm. and we've talked about, say, the mother, the female, mm-hmm. and it can have subsequent problems. Does this, because the nature of how we're all come to being, does this then get passed on to the child?
Are you asking more if the pregnancy complication itself has an influence on the resulting child?
Yes. Or, well, yes, that first, but then also,
are their cells reprogrammed?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm going to answer the first bit of the question first. So what effects of pregnancy complications are on the future offspring?
Yeah.
That is heavily, heavily documented. There's a lot showing that resulting infants from pregnancy complications have metabolic diseases, cardiovascular diseases, specific autoimmune diseases, asthma. There's a lot in the literature that supports that pregnancy complications don't just stop from that pregnancy, but there's later life health outcomes. Back in the 90s, Dr. David Barker, who coined the term the developmental origins of health and disease, otherwise known as DOHAD, basically, that's been an overarching theme of pregnancy research, at least in my lab and what we do. So there's a lot that's been shown to correlate in utero exposures with adverse later life health outcomes.
Right, right.
Specifically, like in the case of inflammatory pregnancy complications, previous work in my lab showed that this, again, was in an animal model, but the pups that came from a pregnancy complication, they had complicated pregnancies when they were bred, when they became of reproductive age.
Right, right.
So that's really interesting to show that there is some sort of persistence.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, if a woman has three miscarriages, but then the fourth goes to term, mm-hmm. I guess the scary thing for her is, what am I passing on?
Yeah, I could see that being a concern, but most of what we're modeling in recurrent pregnancy loss, at least from like our side and what mm-hmm. we're doing, is from the maternal side and how that's mediated. So basically, we're saying that the outcomes of this inflammation-induced pregnancy loss is because of that precedes like any sort of like genetic predisposition that those individuals may have had or anything else.
Right, right. Yeah, because you're not looking at that part. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes, good point.
So this is all isolated to that inflammatory pregnancy complication.
Right.
So like how I mentioned before, individuals who have, there's a lot that shows that people who have preeclampsia, their children may have like metabolic disorders. So like diabetes or cardiovascular disorders like high blood pressure in later life. That's not necessarily because they had that genetic predisposition. They may, but we're saying that these alterations from that pregnancy and that adverse in utero environment, that's what's driving those complications.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's all, it's very tricky, isn't it? And you have to be very careful of how you even say it so people don't misinterpret that, oh, if you've got this, then this is going to happen.
Because exactly.
It's not always the case.
Exactly, yeah.
Because sometimes there's other things that make that happen, not just the first part.
Yeah. It's also really interesting. Like, I was at a conference back in September, and I was presenting a poster, and someone came up to me, and she's like, she's a really well-known and respected placenta researcher, but she's mostly like focused on the genetics of it, everything.
Right.
And she's like, well, yeah, like people with pregnancy complications, like they have that genetic predisposition. And I was like, well, if we look at pregnancy complications, there's a compounded risk every pregnancy. And there's also other like health outcomes that we see in the moms and offspring that aren't explained by just genetics. Like there is some sort of reprogramming happening in the immune system.
Because that could be an environmental factor.
Exactly. Yeah.
For that particular region. We know sometimes, probably speaking out of terms here, but, you know, different things in the water can change our makeup. Different pollution, which it may not happen in a group somewhere else where they don't have that.
Yeah, I think, so I just gave my seminar talk in front of my department a couple of weeks ago, and one of like my opening lines was talking about how pregnancy is a very intricate process that requires a lot of physiological systems. So a lot of the systems in the body to act in a way to orchestrate the success of the pregnancy. However, the immune system is truly at the core and is crucial for orchestrating all the other systems and its success.
Right.
So I think it's important not to think of different systems being in isolation, but rather working together. And I see like the immune system being like the playmaker in that.
And you like playing with that.
It's very fun. I do enjoy quite a lot.
No, but I think you summed that up really well, actually, because it's easy for me to sit here and try and pinpoint.
Yeah.
It's not that simple.
No.
Because there's a lot of other things that are going on that you need to take into consideration.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that are going on you may not even know about.
Yeah. And I think like this is a shout out to like my grade 10 biology teacher, Miss Rogers, if you're out there, I hope you're listening. She once explained, like, think of science, she said biology at the time, but like, think of science as a puzzle. So we're always adding to this puzzle. We're always moving around things, but every piece that you add, that's just growing to the picture. So think if we extrapolate that knowledge and like that understanding to pregnancy, everything is fitting together. We're reshuffling a bit. All this new knowledge that's coming in, all these new studies, exciting experiments, we're just like adding to build that bigger picture. And I don't think that puzzle could ever be fully finished.
No, all those pieces, as you said, coming in is giving us a better understanding.
Exactly.
Because you can, we've had this conversation today.
Yeah.
5 years down the track, our conversation could be totally different.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's constantly changing.
It's a puzzle. Everyone, they lost the border pieces. There's no corner pieces. We don't have the lid to look at the picture.
Right.
We're just trying to figure out the puzzle based on what we have right now.
Love it. And you know what? That is a great way to finish, because I think that that's awesome. And maybe you can come back at another time and tell us the next episode of what you're doing.
I would be delighted to.
That's great. Well, thank you. So that's it, everyone. Another week of a Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Hey, Kingston families looking for an unforgettable summer adventure for your kids? Look no further than ASSIS Camps right on Queen's University campus. ASSIS Camps offers English and French programming for children ages 4 to 12. Campers participate in crafts, games, experiments, field trips, and activities with special weekly guests. ASSIS staff ensures a safe, packed summer with memories that'll last a lifetime. Spots are filling up fast, so register now at assiscamps.ca.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, Village Goddesses of India.
The divine in India is perceived as the ultimate truth. It is idolized in different forms, such as male and female, and also as semi-human, like that of Ganesha, the elephant god. But each one is treated as an individual power, and people all over the country pray to the divine power of their choice. Against this background, this radio program is about our goddesses and how extremely popular they are in the Hindu mind.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, I'm Indu Ramesh from Bangalore, India. Today we are talking about goddesses in Hinduism. I have three friends with me, Vatsala Iyengar, broadcaster, translator, and writer. She has four books to her credit about legends, jewels, and sacred objects used in temples. I guess she is just the right person for this show. I also have Gayatri Balu, an attorney who has specialized in corporate law, keenly interested in theater, as well as both classical and folk music. And Aparna Devagiri, a human resources specialist with a multinational company, again deep into classical music and Hindu philosophy. Before we start the program, let me give you a brief introduction about Hindu deities. In India, goddesses are not ordinary women. Hundreds of them are worshipped in the country. Their images are extremely beautiful. 40 different types of diamond, ruby, emerald, and gold jewels, like the crown, the head jewels, dangling earrings, nose rings, bangles, wristlets, finger rings, waist belt, toe rings, and many more adorn them, making them shine very brightly. They are also dressed in dazzling silks and decorated with strings of flowers. Huge temples are built in their names all over India, and devotees visit these temples in large numbers almost every day to seek the grace of the goddess.
Mugi ge natu chanda, joktiya jadi chanda, kollana gulidali chanda, hennina maimyaga, naga yurige chanda, taiya jadi chanda, taiya jadi chanda.
Her nose ring is enchanting. Her long tresses, her symbol of marriage, her armlet adorning the body of a woman are beauteous. The mother's tresses are beauteous.
At the same time, these goddesses are very powerful. They ride a tiger or a lion and kill demons and devils fighting all alone. There are so many legends and tales about their independence and dominance over the male. What do you say, Gayatri?
In India,
We have a goddess for agriculture, a goddess for epidemic diseases, a goddess for wealth, a goddess for protection of the city, a goddess for knowledge, and even a mighty goddess to kill evil forces. The list of her powers and her various forms is endless. Vatsala has done a lot of research on this topic. Let's hear what she has got to say.
You are right. Perhaps only in India do we come across such a female-oriented worship system.
What is the reason for the popularity of the goddesses in our male-dominated society?
To answer your question, we have to go back to the very beginning of Indian civilization. As you know, India is basically an agricultural country with over 70% of its population in rural areas. So, naturally, people gave great importance to fertility of the soil and strong sons to cultivate the land.
ಏಳು ತಲೆದ್ದು ಎದ್ದು ಯಾರ್ಯಾರ ನೆನೆಯಲಿ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಭೂತಾಯ ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದ್ಯಾವು ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದ್ಯಾವು
ಅಟ್ ದ ಬ್ರೇಕ್ ಆಫ್ ಡಾನ್ ದ ಸನ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಸಾಯಿಲ್ ಪ್ರೇಸ್ ಟು ದ ಆಲ್ ಇಂಪಾರ್ಟೆಂಟ್ ಮದರ್ ಅರ್ತ್ who fills his field with the aroma of spices. Is there a better way to start his day? In the second stanza, this cultivator makes a votive offering to his family deity to help him grow maize.
Mooda muttaya muttaya noda badatana moodlalli ragi meleyudda ಮೂಡ್ಲಲ್ಲಿ ರಾಗಿ ಬೆಳೆಯುತ್ತ ಬೆಳೆದರೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿಸೇವೆ
ಟು ಪ್ರೇ ಫಾರ್ ದೀಸ್ ಬ್ಲೆಸ್ಸಿಂಗ್ಸ್ ವಿಲೇಜ್ ಗಾಡಸಸ್ ವರ್ ಕ್ರಿಯೇಟೆಡ್ ಆ್ಯಂಡ್ ವರ್ ವರ್ಶಿಪ್ಡ್ ಆಸ್ ಮದರ್ ಗಾಡಸ್ ಅಂಡರ್ ದ ಕಾಮನ್ ನೇಮ್ ಆಫ್ ದೇವಿ ಮಾತಾ ಆ್ಯಂಡ್ ಅಮ್ಮ The name of the village was also associated with the goddess to establish her power over the area. In fact, even Mumbai got its name because of Mumba Devi, its guardian goddess, and likewise Kolkata from Kali. Let me tell you about an interesting episode. In South India, in the state of Karnataka, by the beginning of the Christian era, food gatherers would place a few neem leaves in their basket with the belief that this would ensure a good collection of food. Neem, as you know, is antibacterial, antifungus vegetation. In a tropical country like India, neem leaves are considered to be helpful in curing diseases like pox, plague, etc., and it is believed that health-granting goddesses can ward off such epidemic diseases. Thus, there are goddesses who carry the name of Plague Amma, Pox Amma, etc. There is even an AIDS Amma for curing this disease. Such is the belief people have in the power of their mother. Always think of a goddess as someone beautiful, wearing silks and jewels, etc. But there are many exceptions.
That's true. Not all goddesses are good looking. In Bangalore rural district, a goddess suffers from defective vision. She cannot see anything nearby and has a long sight. So the nearby devotees do not receive any favor from her. On the other hand, people from distant places get her boons.
I will not be surprised if a devotee presents a pair of contact lenses or glasses to the goddess so that she can see even those who are nearby to bless them. To continue our story, about 200 years ago, plague hit a place called Sirsi in our state, and even the British officer's daughter suffered from this disease. Though a non-believer in Hindu tradition, this officer prayed to the goddess and his daughter was cured. As a further remedy, the wooden image of the goddess was transported from the village and left at the outskirts of another village. This place also did the same, and so did the next village, until the image was finally immersed in the sea. This event is still carried out as a grand festival. In many places, there is no image of the goddess. She can just be a belly stone within the village. At times, she is only a head-shaped stone placed at the outskirts. On this stone, a mustache could be carved or painted to stress her manly powers. Or she could just be a tree. Her body is the village itself, and she has grown roots in its soil.
This concept of a village goddess also has different meanings. For example, just as a child goes to his mother and complains about somebody who has not treated him properly, the villager goes to the temple and complains about somebody who has done him wrong. The mother naturally punishes the wrongdoer, as this story illustrates. Gayatri?
Here is the story. In a particular village of South India, anyone who has been cheated by another person takes a fowl to the shrine of the goddess. He kills the bird, dips his hand in its blood, and thinking of his enemy, smears the wall of the shrine with blood. Once he returns to the village, his enemy suffers from diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and convulsions. Repenting for his sin, the afflicted person offers worship to the goddess and thus ends the enmity. So, the village goddess is the judge to provide justice to the aggrieved person. This method of seeking justice in the presence of the goddess is a very common practice in the villages.
Just goes to show that protection of her people is foremost for her. I think even the concept of fertility of the soil and crops rising out of the earth is still very important to the concept of the village deities.
This is a story my mother used to tell us when we were children and first about eating vegetables. Once upon a time, a drought occurred in central India, and sages prayed to a forest goddess by name Banashankari for rains. Unable to bear their suffering, the goddess wept continuously for 9 nights, and her tears filled up lakes and ponds, irrigating the land. She also produced vegetation out of her body and came to be called Shakambari. She is still worshipped in the month of October with 108 varieties of vegetables and fruits.
From fertility, the goddess is also capable of protecting against snake bites, scorpion bites, etc. In one temple, a scorpion appears on a particular day of the year, receives the food given by devotees, and slips away. The goddess is called Vrishikeshwari, Vrishika meaning the scorpion, and this tradition still continues. In many parts of India, a snake pit is also worshipped to pray for children.
Manasa is a North Indian snake goddess, and a tale tells us that when a trader ignored the deity, all his 6 sons were bitten by a poisonous snake. It was only after he realized his mistake and prayed to Manasa did she restore the lives of his sons. In the earlier era, women who gave up their life for the welfare of the community were also worshipped.
There was once severe floods in a village, and a lady by name Channamma protected the entire area
by holding both her hands as a barricade against the gushing waters. She lost her arms and died, but was immortalized as a goddess. Her image has no hands, and she is fondly called as the armless Amma.
There are many mythological stories about women who suffered injustice at the hands of males and became goddesses.
Mariam of South India is an example where a young Brahmin girl is tricked into marriage by a lower caste man. She becomes very angry at this betrayal and kills herself. She punishes her husband by burning him into ashes and transforms herself into a goddess. At these temples, the husband is often shown as a male beast.
I have in fact witnessed a festival in a goddess temple where the male is symbolically humiliated and sent out of the village as punishment. This is really very interesting, as it helps us understand the fierce independence and dominance of a woman over her male consorts in traditional Hindu society in ancient times.
You mean to say that men are often cast in disruptive roles and the village goddess is equated with a civilized and just society?
It's true.
Do you think it is the result of matrilineal societies that existed in ancient India?
Yes. In ancient India, mother right was the basis of social system of the agricultural people. Agriculture was the discovery of the woman. She was the first cultivator of the soil, and her child-bearing capability was similar to the vegetative power of the earth. The normal happenings of wind, rain, sunshine, even storms and eclipses could not be explained by the tribal people. They were explained as something from the heavens. The fact that the tree blooms with flowers and then fruits, which is used so happily by the community, must have given rise to the idea of nature as mother. Thus, the initial stages of this economy upheld the supremacy of the woman. The life-producing power of the mother became the central figure of tribal and rural religion. Mother Earth became the womb in which crops were sown. Female figures with a bulging womb and huge sexual organs were carved and were offered magical rites to increase fertility. Thus, primitive mother goddess cult was an important feature of our religion. This identification of earth with woman is universal and can be found in all ancient cultures and civilizations across the world. That is why the cult of the mother goddess has been a very important feature of our religion.
When we speak of the term mother for the goddess of India, we must bear in mind that this word suggests a mother's nurturing aspect rather than act of physical childbearing. Lakshmi is the mother of all, but she bore no children. Nor did Saraswati, the goddess of knowledge. Parvati, the consort of Shiva, is the mother of the elephant god Ganesha and Skanda, the warrior god. But she did not bear them in her womb. This is a very strange fact, as in Indian society, a bride is fully accepted only after she gives birth to a baby.
Another very funny thing is, in spite of being called as mother, the village goddess is a virgin and unmarried. Her untamed sexual energy is magically turned into a very powerful destruction of the demons who are men. Bursting with this energy, she is unrefined, consumes country liquor, and enjoys eating raw meat. So, animal and blood sacrifices are commonly offered to the goddess to please her. Talking about blood, the menstrual flow is believed to make the land fertile, and there is a very fascinating tale behind this. Shakti, the wife of Shiva, one of the major Hindu gods, dies. And unable to bear her death, Shiva roams about like a madman, carrying her dead body over his shoulders. To make him put it down, the other gods cut the body into pieces and make them fall at several places. Her female organ fell at one such place, and the fossilized stone is said to menstruate for 3 days in a year. Thousands of people visit this temple in the northeastern part of India to pray to the goddess on this occasion.
There's a strong relationship between a village goddess and trees. People believe that the goddess lives in these trees and hence do not cut them. Instead, they wrap a sari around the tree, apply turmeric and vermilion, and wave lamps at the tree. There is this story of a village chieftain near Bangalore who cut a banyan tree, not realizing that goddess of good fortune resides in it. He used the wood for household purposes and met a gory death. Trees and plants are also held very sacred in India, and many of them are worshipped as goddesses. Among them, the most popular plant all over India is the basil plant and is called Tulsi. Each traditional house has a small square earthen pot in the backyard where Tulsi is planted, and daily a lamp is lit in her favor.
This tradition has a lot of scientific explanations also.
Tula means one who is incomparable and true to the name. Tulsi leaves have a lot of medicinal value and have proved to be helpful in improving digestion, in curing ailments like gallbladder stones, jaundice, cough, cold, etc. Just one leaf of Tulsi a day can reduce the blood sugar level as well as cholesterol. It can improve the digestive system and can reduce fever.
No wonder today many popular brands of tea contain Tulsi leaves.
Tulsi is considered to be the beloved of Krishna and Vishnu, and a garland of Tulsi leaves is said to be the best floral offering to please the god.
Talking about trees and plants, I would like to tell our listeners about the plant forms of Durga. And foremost among them is banana, a very auspicious plant all over India. Raw banana is used in curries. Ripe ones are eaten as fruits. Its leaves are used as plates on all traditional occasions and marriages, and its bark is used for craft decorations. Turmeric is used as a basic seasoning in every type of Indian cooking. It too has many medicinal properties and is also used as a remedy for minor cuts and bruises. It is the plant form of Durga herself. The wood apple tree is considered to be very sacred, and a single leaf offered with devotion is equal to an elaborate offering. The fruit of the tree is very cooling and is useful in stomach ailments. The goddess of this tree is Shakti, that is, energy personified. Pomegranate fruit is described as the blood-colored teeth of the goddess. Ashoka is a very sacred tree in our country and is believed to increase fertility. A goddess called one who is free from sorrow lives in this tree. Harvested rice or paddy is a highly auspicious food grain, and no feast or festival is complete without offering it to Lakshmi, called as Dhanya Lakshmi. We worship other traditional plants and trees as goddesses, as they make us feel good.
Trees as goddesses and gods have been well established in India. For example, the neem tree is female and the sacred banyan is male. In our country, villagers often face severe drought, and their way of pleasing the rain god is to celebrate the marriage of the neem and the banyan trees. They plant these saplings and conduct a regular marriage, just as they would do for their children. Slowly, the place around the saplings becomes a meeting place for the villagers, and a small temple comes up there. I have seen one such temple and some 60-year-old neem and banyan trees in a village about 150 miles from Bangalore. I was lucky to find an old lady there, almost blind, who remembered the planting, the marriage, and how the rain god appeared in their village, bringing the much-needed water.
Let me add an amusing story. There is a village goddess by name Kabbalamma. Once she had an argument with her husband as to who is the superior of the two. So they take a bet that whoever goes to the market and buys all the essential things for the house without spending even a cent would win. And the winner has to pour burning coal over the loser's head. So first the husband goes to the market and comes back defeated, as he obviously cannot buy anything without spending money. Now comes the turn of our heroine. She creates a hurricane in the market, and the traders close their eyes to avoid dust. She picks up whatever she wants and comes home triumphantly. On a particular day of the summer months, strong winds blow over the village, and the goddess symbolizes the winds. As part of the event, burning coal is poured over her husband's image. This legend tells us how intelligent and quick-witted a goddess can be.
Just another shoplifter story. It goes to show that being so close to her devotees, the goddess naturally takes on their characteristics, including the very common husband and wife tiffs. Or maybe symbolic gestures are used to tell the story.
Hindu, I would like to say here that just like you or me or any woman, the moods of the goddesses are many. At times, she gets angry and furious and throws a tantrum if not appeased. She loves good clothes and gifts. At the same time, she's so down to earth and practical. She protects people, thus proving herself to be beneficial. She is loved by everybody, and in turn, she loves them, just like a caring mother.
I totally agree with you. Each symbolic gesture and each story about the Indian goddess is full of romance, courage, foresight, kindness, leadership, and so many other good qualities.
No wonder the village goddess has rulers, traders, farmers, and in fact, people from all sections of the society virtually falling at her feet, praising her and adoring her.
Does it mean that in India only village goddesses are worshipped?
No, there are many more sophisticated goddesses. We will talk about them in our next show. To end, thank you, Vatsala, for the painstaking research you have done. Gayatri and Aparna, thank you for your very good inputs. The recording for this show was done by M. R. Ramamurthy, and I am Indu Ramesh, signing off from Bangalore, India, for Wings.
Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Livana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo. Cuomo, my goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7.